From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young in Cleveland. It's Here and Now. And here at the Republican National Convention, it's anyone's guess what Donald Trump will do or say when he gets on stage at Quicken Loans Arena tonight. He already made a World Wrestling-worthy entrance early in the week. And Meghna, as you know, jaws dropped last night when Ted Cruz was booed off the stage for not endorsing Donald Trump. But if those jaws could drop further, they did this morning. When Cruz defended himself meeting with the Texas delegation, he told cheering and jeering delegates that he would not vote for Hillary Clinton, that he didn't want people to write in his name on the ballot, and that he broke his pledge to support the party nominee because, remember, when Trump retweeted unflattering pictures of Cruz's wife Heidi and then threatened to spill the beans about her and alleged that Cruz's father was connected to the Kennedy assassination.
And that pledge was not a blanket commitment that if you go and slander and attack Heidi, that I'm going to nonetheless come like a servile puppy dog and say thank you very much for maligning my wife and maligning my father. What does it say when you stand up and say, vote your conscience, and rabid supporters of our nominee begin screaming, what a horrible thing to say. If we can't make the case to the American people that voting for our party's nominee is consistent with voting your conscience, is consistent with defending freedom and being faithful to the Constitution, then we are not going to win and we don't deserve to win. That's how you win elections.
Let's bring in Here Now's political analyst, Paris Denard, Republican strategist, Trump supporter, and our real supporter here this week. And Paris, you know, a lot of people are gleeful about this. You know, food fight, you don't look happy. You look upset.
This was totally inappropriate. Robin, I told you yesterday that you cannot trust Ted Cruz. I said you cannot trust what he's going to do. Donald Trump was right when he called him Lion Ted. It was inappropriate. It was wrong. He signed a pledge. And this is the problem that evangelicals have with Ted Cruz. Puts his hand on the Bible, says he's an evangelical, and he does things like these dirty tricks that he did with Ben Carson. Then he goes out here and does not do this positive speech for Donald Trump. He was asked to give a speech. He should have given this. If he didn't want to say anything positive, if he didn't want to endorse Donald Trump, and if he didn't want to sign the pledge and agree to the pledge, he should have never come out there and
spoke. You know, the Trump campaign is being criticized for not foreseeing many of the problems that happened this week, including this one. And some people are even saying the Trump campaign saw this speech beforehand. You have to load these things into teleprompters. And so maybe they were turning the table on Ted Cruz, knowing he was going to do this. They made they had an entrance for Donald Trump. They had their whips down in the arena, whipping up the booze.
Donald Trump tweeted he saw his speech 2 hours before. Yeah. What happened was, once again, Donald Trump trumped Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
And he played right into his hand and said, you know what, let's see if he's going to be a man of his word and be a man of integrity. And what happened was Donald Trump came in, stole the thunder from him, got the applause line, and let Ted Cruz show himself
walk off the stage
with
to booze.
And many of them from the New York delegation and even the Texas delegation was upset with him for that.
Yeah, but I got to say, thinking of the Texas delegation this morning, that was astonishing. It went on forever. At first, the delegation was screaming at him, yelling out, you know, angry at him. But then when he reminded them what Donald Trump did, retweeting this negative tweet about his wife, they seemed to come around to him.
If I shake your hand and tell you after I forgive you, and I shake your hand and say we're going to do this and we have an agreement, that's a gentleman's agreement. As a man, that's what you do. Mm-hmm. If Ted Cruz was over, he should have let it be in the past and move forward and unite this party around Donald Trump to win in November.
Well, it ended up overshadowing a lot of things, including Donald Trump's VP pick, Mike Pence.
Great speech.
Well, but not a lot of people heard it. They were talking about other things. And he was on Fox and Friends this morning before he was again upstaged by Cruz speaking this morning. But let's listen to Mike Pence.
I think what you're seeing is a party that's coming together. There's always going to be differences and nuances in the way people express that. But what I sensed in that hall the last several days, and especially last night, is a Republican Party that is coming together around the stakes of this election and the choice of this election. And I think you're going to see that more and more.
Okay, so there you have Mike Pence speaking today in a very calm, reasoned way. But that's not what's making the headlines today.
That's the sad thing about this convention so far. There's a lot of positive things that are going on that people are not seeing. You know, Thurgood Marshall College Fund has 8 HBCU students that are here volunteering. They're loving it and they're meeting. You know, this is the first time the RNC let that happen and wanted them to be here. There's panels going on that are substantive with millennials, minorities, and that's being lost by the shenanigans of people like Ted Cruz.
You know, and Mike Pence is being further overshadowed by the news that the New York Times is reporting that the John Kasich campaign was asked by the Trump campaign, one of Trump's sons, if he would want to be the VP. John Kasich, Ohio governor, is shunning the entire convention. When that gets out that, you know, he might have been asked to be VP when he's dissing Trump, it's messy.
You have to ask the question, is it never Trump or never Hillary? If we don't unite behind Donald Trump, we are going to lose in November, period. We've got to get on board, put your egos and personal opinions aside, and be for this party. And if you have a problem with Donald Trump, all these governors, senators, help him get to the point where you can be like Speaker Ryan and Mitch McConnell and say, there's bigger things that are more important than my ego.
Here now, political analyst Paris Denard, Republican strategist, Trump supporter, and our great help here at the RNC. And I can't wait to hear from you tomorrow after Donald Trump speaks. Paris, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure, Robin.
All right, well, let's move on to other news. The hashtag Free Milo is gaining steam in some corners of the internet. It's being pushed by online supporters of Milo Yiannopoulos, the technology editor at the conservative news site Breitbart. That's because Twitter banned Yiannopoulos from its platform, saying he incited and contributed to ugly social media abuse of Ghostbusters star Leslie Jones. Jones' Twitter account was bombarded with racist and obscene tweets that were so bad, Jones quit Twitter on Monday, saying, quote, I leave Twitter tonight with tears and a very sad heart. Joining us now to talk about this case and what companies can do and are doing about online harassment is Soraya Shamali. She's the director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project. And Soraya, what do you think? I mean, was Twitter right to ban Milo Yiannopoulos?
So I think Twitter was right to ban him insofar as they have terms of service and guidelines for the community of people that use Twitter, and he had violated those terms of service. It's a little difficult, I think, to know when a person crosses that threshold and why the violations seem to exist on a mysterious spectrum. But clearly, it's a private company. They have these guidelines, and they are well within the parameters of what you would expect in those situations to ban him.
Right. So Twitter has said that they banned him for participating in or inciting targeted abuse of individuals. But of course, as you know, his supporters are claiming that the ban is an infringement of his free speech rights. Your reaction to that?
Well, I think it shows a pretty common but profound misunderstanding of things like the First Amendment. This is not the government. He can go to many other forms of social media. He can speak wherever he wants. I think the issue here is not clearly one of free speech insofar as the law is concerned, because it doesn't have any relevance in this context.
So, I mean, Leslie Jones was the target of really vile attacks, racist, they were obscene. I mean, it was awful to the point where she just felt like she could not be on Twitter anymore. That made me wonder. I mean, Twitter banning Milo Yiannopoulos has gotten all the headlines. But, you know, all of those hundreds or thousands of people who sent the hateful tweets to Jones, I don't see Twitter banning them. I mean, they're still there. So where should the company act? Where does it draw the line? I mean, I feel like that's really sort of the heart of the matter, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, what she experienced is something that many Black feminists in particular have described experiencing. And it's very common. The kind of verbal assault that she experienced is something that we see over and over and over again. It seems to take the outrage and abuse of a celebrity to catalyze action, and that's always disappointing.
Well, can I just jump in here? Because I think that's a really important point that, you know, Leslie Jones had the power of her celebrity that both attracted the abuse but also produced the response from Twitter. I mean, there have been many, many other women, and women especially, online who have, received death threats or equally hateful tweets from people and have sought out assistance from Twitter and haven't gotten it because they lack that celebrity power. I mean, it feels like Twitter itself, and in fact, they've acknowledged they've got a long way to go in quote, curbing this type of behavior.
You know, for several years now, many activists and civil society advocates have worked with Twitter, have challenged Twitter to make some fundamental changes. And one of the issues is the difference between policy and products. There are policies, like the terms of service, and those always require human interpretation. So in this instance, what was the moment at which he tilted over the edge and Twitter said, okay, you violated these guidelines too many times or into an egregious way? That's very different from product changes, investments in engineering, changes that you would make to the fundamental structure of a platform that would reduce the likelihood of this kind of abuse. And that's expensive. It's harder. It requires, I think, a lot more input than maybe Twitter has been willing to incorporate, not just in terms of policy or some sort of simple button changes, but actually in terms of information flow and user controls.
Hmm. Soraya Shamali is the director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
There are about 15,000 credentialed journalists covering the RNC, and one Northeast Ohio middle schooler has the rare opportunity to be one of them. Reporter Michelle Faust of Here and Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream has this profile of the youngest reporter at the RNC.
I was pretty young when I started reporting, but few start as young as Mabel Bisher. This thin, blonde, bespectacled 13-year-old knows exactly what she wants to do.
I've always been a writer.
Bisher is one of 10 reporters for Time for Kids, a spinoff of Time magazine that's distributed to 4 million elementary school students across the country. This summer, Bisher will be the magazine's only credentialed kid reporter on the floor of the Quicken Loans Arena covering the Republican National Convention.
The 2016 Republican National Convention, RNC, is taking place in Cleveland, Ohio from July 18th to 21st, 2016.
Bisher wrote this article as part of her application for the kid reporter job.
National political conventions are the Super Bowl of meetings, says David Gilbert, president and CEO of the 2016 Cleveland Host Committee.
She spoke to chairman of the Republican Party of her county, the Republican Party of Ohio. She was able to really kind of hone in on really reliable sources.
That's Laura Blackburn. She's an associate editor at Time for Kids. She says a major reason Bisher was chosen to report from the convention was the story she wrote on Cleveland's preparation for the RNC. Maple's father, Michael Bisher, says he's proud of his daughter's work, and he's excited that the family will be accompanying Maple to the RNC.
It's the biggest event happening in Cleveland in her lifetime, with all due respect to the Cavs.
The historic nature of the convention with its controversial likely nominee isn't lost on Maple.
I would like to talk to delegates.
Bisher says she wants to learn what it's like to be in the shoes of one of the 2,472 Republican delegates.
At the convention, they're entrusted to vote for the candidate who their state selected, even though their own political views might not support that same candidate.
And what would she ask the candidate, Donald Trump, if she gets the chance?
And I think I might ask him why he thinks people don't support him or don't like him for president.
13-year-old Mabel Bisher says she doesn't think her age will be a problem for her covering the convention. In some ways, she says her age may be an advantage.
Since I'm young, I do have a different perspective because it's new and it's fresh and exciting, and I haven't ever experienced this stuff before. I was only 8 or 9 when the last presidential race was.
Of the estimated 15,000 credentialed reporters here at the RNC, Bisher will likely be the only one who won't be eligible to vote for president until 2024. For Here and Now, I'm Michelle Faust.
Well, we checked in with Mabel Bisher. She got her wish and interviewed many young Republican delegates on the floor of the RNC. And she will be watching to hear what Donald Trump says tonight. And she probably won't hear here or from the Democrats in Philadelphia anything about the housing crisis. It's over, right? Well, wrong. We all remember what happened. Poisonous bad loans with exploding interest rates were resold by Wall Street, infecting the entire financial system. People couldn't pay. The whole thing blew up, leaving behind abandoned neighborhoods. Well, now a new study from the Economic Innovation Group named Cleveland the most distressed large city in the U.S. 13% of housing in this city is vacant. So while we were here in Cleveland, we wanted to see it for ourselves. Jim Rokakis is the former Democratic state treasurer. He's now with the Thriving Communities Institute, and we met up in a lovely area east of downtown.
This is the University Circle area. You've got Case Western Reserve University.
We're on the campus of the Cleveland Museum of Art.
One of the best museums in the country.
And the botanical gardens. I mean, it's
botanical gardens, the Museum of Natural History. We've got Cleveland Institute of Art.
Cleveland Clinic down the road.
It's just down the road.
But you want us to see what?
Well, we're within a mile of some of the most distressed areas in the city. The foreclosure crisis did a real number on this part of the country. We had over 100,000 foreclosures in a 10-year period, and it resulted in an 18% population loss in the city. The only city that lost more population percentage-wise was the city of Detroit.
Okay, so you want us to go see? Let's go see.
Sure.
Jim and others are pushing to demolish more blighted buildings than the city already has. The state just released about $100 million additional dollars from the Treasury Department's Foreclosure Relief Program. One problem, the money can't be used for multifamily buildings. And as we'll see, part of Cleveland's blight is old abandoned brick apartment buildings. Another problem, there are people who don't want demolition. We headed down Euclid Avenue past coffee shops and a garden store.
So we're about to cross, though, this bridge is the dividing line. We're going from this vibrant, booming neighborhood into one of the most distressed communities in the state of Ohio. It's a community
just like that.
Just like that. It's called East Cleveland. East Cleveland is one of the poorest communities in the state of Ohio. They're in fiscal emergency. They don't have money to pay their police. They don't have money to pay their firemen. So here we are. We're entering East Cleveland, and then we quickly hit what will be some of the worst blight you're going to see.
This is reminding me so much of Flint, Michigan, parts of Flint, Michigan. Some of these are nice, you know, bigger homes, but there's holes in the walls.
It is very tragic. Some of these houses are the most beautiful homes. If you look to your right, you can tell they have historic qualities. They were built in the late 1800s.
Big, wide porches.
But there you are, abandoned, boarded, abandoned, boarded. Look to your left. Look at that multifamily.
Oh, my gosh.
All empty.
By the way, we'll have pictures at hearandnow.org so people can follow along. But that unit that we just saw, pretty. In its day, it must have been.
And you could just tell there was a lot of... Look at the brickwork around the window. It's quality. It's granite. It's
kind of a Tudor, but it's completely falling down.
This community, as I said, has been in fiscal distress or emergency for almost a generation now. They're unable to borrow. The state auditor, who I met with recently, is angry. This is a community that has seen abandonment, not unlike what you see in Detroit.
But well, you mentioned anger. You have your critics. There are people, including City Councilman Jeff Johnson, who say rehab. And, you know, I have to say, Jim, we just passed that. That would be blocks of housing that would be taken out. He says, don't demolish, that you've got just one tool in your toolbox, and that tool is, if it's an empty house, tear it down.
Well, the reality is that's not true. The land bank that I set up here, and I've now got 36 of them in the state of Ohio we've helped to set up, probably rehabs one house for every three they take down. Where there is a market and where there is interest in rehabilitating that property, the property is rehabilitated. The problem is the cost of rehabilitating some of these older structures is so high that it's actually easier to build new. Okay, but let's assume for a second it's worth preserving because it's a historic structure. Then the question is, where do you get the money? And if you talk to people in those neighborhoods, we completed a study last summer. We surveyed 160,000 properties. Not once did any resident come out and say, please save this property. Please preserve this property. The overwhelming sentiment of people in those neighborhoods is, how soon can you take that property down?
Well, it brings down their property value. It's dangerous for kids.
Well, here's what it's done to the property values. The average neighborhood on this side of town is probably now 80% of the equity or the value has been lost since 2005. We did a study that proved to the county that when these buildings don't pay property taxes, it creates a greater burden on the communities where property taxes are being paid.
It's a vicious cycle, too.
$43 million in property tax burdens got shifted from these neighborhoods to more stable neighborhoods. You may think because you live in a suburb, this isn't your problem. It is, and you're paying for it. going to take you down a street here. It was a beautiful street where people lived who worked downtown. They'd come out here to the corner at Euclid and take the streetcar. They're beautiful buildings. The entire neighborhood has been abandoned.
Oh, my gosh. Look at this. This is breathtaking.
This is America, by the way. This isn't a third world country.
So we're heading down a street which is completely cracked and grass is growing through it. At the end of the street, we can see this complete garbage. Looks like old chairs and debris dumped in the street. Oh, to our left, there's a house that's apparently been demolished but not cleared out. It's just, that is a disaster area for children. It's just all bricks and old wood and nails and things. And then to our right, these big, beautiful brick buildings that are completely abandoned. But I can see what you're saying. Those lots are there, but who's going to buy and build on that lot until these buildings are gone?
Right. Well, that's the whole point, that if you clear all of this, you're creating a 20-acre site within a mile of University Circle. It's a developable site. It's not developable now. So the question is, what do you do with this? And if you can save some, you should. But the neighborhood I just took you through, there's nothing to be saved there.
That's Jim Rakokas with the Thriving Communities Institute, part of the Western Reserve Land Conservancy. They want to see those abandoned blocks turned into green space or sold and built on. Your thoughts. Does your city or town have blight? What's your plan? Let us know and check out these pictures. Not just abandoned homes, but blocks of old brick apartment buildings.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
Brazil's justice minister announced that 10 people have been arrested on suspicion of supporting the so-called Islamic State and of plotting terrorist attacks during the Olympic Games, which are set to begin in Rio just 2 weeks from tomorrow. Also today, the sporting world's highest appeals court has rejected Russia's efforts to overturn a ban barring that country's track and field athletes from participating in the Rio Games. So let's take a closer look at that story with Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts Slate's daily podcast, The Gist, and he joins us from New York. Hi there, Mike.
Hi.
So first of all, what does this mean for Russia's track athletes? Do they have any more chances to argue their case?
Not to argue, but the final decision rests with the Olympic Committee themselves, although Thomas Bach, who is the president, the German who is in charge of that, a former Olympian himself, answered reporters' questions saying, will he uphold the court? This is before the arbitration ruling came out, and he said, yes, he would be upholding that. It's widely expected that the recommendations of the federation will be followed through, and that's an important thing because the Olympics are a collection of countries, but also a collection of federations. When the sport itself says we do not want these athletes participating. And also it's important because we're going to talk about an entire ban on the entire country of Russia. But there's been a little bit of time to sort of process this. So it's expected that it will be upheld. But there's always a chance that, you know, the Olympics will let some of these athletes in.
OK, so talk to me about what you just mentioned. That is there a possibility that the ban could be extended to Russia's entire team?
There is. And this is because the reason that the athletics, which is what track and field is called internationally, what tripped them up was a whistleblower. They looked into the track athletes. But then there was an expanded report. It's the McLaren report. He's a Canadian lawyer. And he put out that there were hundreds of examples of squirrely samples, let's say. And the recommendation of WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, is that the entire country of Russia not be allowed to have any of its athletes compete under its flag. This was signed on to, it's been reported, by such countries as America, Germany, Canada, Spain, and a number of sports organizations, too. This is the country that is expected to come in third in Olympics. This is a huge country. It would be a shocking development, but what Russia has apparently done is equally shocking. Where August 5th is when the games start. We're 2 weeks to the games. So yeah. The Olympics have a tough decision to make in a quick amount of time.
And of course, the Russians are responding very strongly. I'm seeing Russia's sports minister, Vitaly Mutko, being quoted on Twitter saying it's time to disband the International Association of Athletics Federations. Yelena Isinbayeva, a two-time Olympic pole vault champion, has said, "Thank you, everyone, for the funeral of athletics." I mean, your thoughts there?
And of course, patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. And what the Russians did is certainly terrible. And they really seem to have been involved in state-sponsored doping. However, there are other arguments on the other side, such as collective punishment. It is almost certainly the case that some of these athletes did not dope. Many of them are not in sports where doping really helps. There is doping, say, in gymnastics, but no Russian gymnast has been implicated. And there's no evidence that a Russian gymnast ever doped or doped under the protocols of this cheating regime. So yeah, some innocence would be published, but what's the message you want to give? This is what the Olympics has to decide.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst, and he also hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
The recent shootings of police officers in Baton Rouge and Dallas have, of course, heightened the discussion around guns, policing, and race in America. But the shootings brought another issue to the fore as well. Both shooters, Gavin Long in Baton Rouge and Micah Johnson in Dallas, were veterans with apparent mental health issues. So joining us now with some perspective on this is Dr. Elspeth Cameron Ritchie. She's a psychiatrist and formerly the Army's top mental health officer. She now does work with the Department of Veterans Affairs. Dr. Ritchie, welcome.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here today, although it's a very difficult subject we're going to talk about.
Well, first of all, I mean, let me just start off with the fact that in the spate of violence, terrible violence that we've been seeing this month, we have a situation in which both the shooters and some of the victims, some of the law enforcement victims, were both former members of the military. And I wonder if you have a concern about how current veterans are experiencing this terrible news cycle.
Absolutely. But first, let me put it in some context. We've had over 2.7 million service members deploy to Iraq and Afghanistan. So we have a large number who have returned home, and veterans often go into law enforcement. Having said that, every veteran fears the idea of the veteran as a ticking time bomb. And these mass shooting, these slayings of police officers by former veterans, certainly disturb the larger veteran community.
Now, no one is saying that the shooter's military service had anything specifically or directly to do with the violent acts they perpetrated here in the United States. But I think it is worth noting that, for example, Micah Johnson, the shooter in Dallas, his parents did say that after his 6 years of service in the military, something changed in him, and that he went from being a gregarious young man into a hermit. So I'm wondering what your reaction is to that, and you know what that means about how mental health services that are offered to veterans.
I cannot speak directly to Micah Johnson, but what I can say is everybody who goes to war is changed, and sometimes it's a positive way and sometimes negative and sometimes mixed. The general public has heard a lot about post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Another term that should be used more often is called moral injury, and that's a sense of somebody having shame or guilt or feeling wounded by what it is that they have done or saw. And again, I can't speak to these two specific cases, but I do see many veterans who are suffering with shame or guilt, as well as post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, so tell us more about that, because, I mean, soldiers are trained to fight, to experience violence and, you know, mete out violence in the theater of war. So I'm wondering, is coping with that moral injury that you talked about also part of their training?
It is to a certain extent. As you say, they are trained to fight, to shoot, to do their job under difficult circumstances, which can include killing. What I think is harder to prepare for is perhaps the guilt you feel after shooting somebody, especially, for example, if the victims are children. You know, the film American Sniper depicted that, I thought, quite well. It's also hard if you've lost colleagues, and you can sort of be trained to shrug it off. But if you've got a buddy who's been blown away, that's very hard to make sense of in your life.
Well, there has been a long and intense discussion in the country about whether or not the military and the VA are doing enough to support soldiers when they do come home. I mean, what's your view on that? Are they getting the tools and the support they need to cope with the transition at home?
I am not speaking for the military or the VA here. I need to make that clear. But I would say that both are doing everything they can, but more is needed. So I always urge my civilian counterparts to learn about the military culture and to step up and be ready to treat the military. Again, we've had 2.7 million service members deploy recently, and that's on top of many, many millions who have served in other wars. For example, the Vietnam-era veterans I see a lot of now, and they are needing help and support as well 50 years after the war in Vietnam. So more certainly can be done.
Well, let's take a step back here for a moment. I mean, what do we know about rates of violence among veterans in the United States, whether it's violence towards others or to themselves as well?
A lot is known about the suicide rate, both in active duty and among veterans. The normal term is 22 veterans kill themselves a day. So that's a lot. And in the active duty military, it has been going up since about 2004. Recently has stabilized somewhat, but still unacceptably high, especially in the National Guard and reserves. The rates of violence we know less about, but what we do know is that veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder have a slightly higher incidence of domestic violence and of gun violations, and that's what they tend to get arrested with. And that's not really surprising. Being deployed to war strains relationships, puts a lot of pressure on them, and then veterans are trained to handle weapons, and they often feel most comfortable with a weapon. And this is unfortunate. One of the things I do in my practice, I always ask veterans about firearms and discuss other ways that they can feel safe. In some cases, I'll recommend that they get a dog, for example, which is a lot less lethal than a firearm.
Dr. Ritchie, I feel like I really must ask, you spent 28 years in the military. Do you think it is significant at all that both the shooters in Dallas and Baton Rouge, in these very high-profile killings, were former members of the military? Because there are a lot of veterans out there who are saying that we shouldn't even be talking about the fact that that both these men were members of the military, because it has nothing to do, in their view, nothing to do with what happened. And I'm wondering what you think about that reaction, and whether or not you think that's a fair criticism.
I think there's probably other factors at play that are more important. For example, risk factors for violence in the general population include delusions, paranoia, irritability, and anger. And what the news reports have said about these two shooters, it seems that delusions, paranoia, and anger factored in there. Now, the fact that we're veterans may or may not have made their shooting more accurate, and I don't think you can discount that, but I think the other pieces are very important as well.
Well, Dr. Ritchie, tell me a little bit more. I mean, what do you see as the relationship between mental illness and violence?
Persons with mental illness are far more likely to be victims of violence than to victimize others. Having said that, there are certain types and characteristics of mental illness that heighten the risk for violence. And these are delusions, paranoia, irritability, substance abuse, and anger at colleagues at the workplace.
I'm curious. For some particular mental illnesses, the age in which symptoms can arise is, you know, late teens, maybe early 20s, which is exactly the same time frame in which many people join or are members of the military. I mean, does the military do anything to sort of to keep an eye out for signs of mental illness while a soldier is serving?
Absolutely. Yes, you're correct that schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, manic depression, do tend to emerge in the late teens and early 20s. And the military has a number of different ways to screen and assess for signs of mental illness. They do have a screen before somebody joins, and if you've had a history of a severe mental disorder, you're not supposed to be able to get into the military. And then there's a variety of personnel who are looking out for signs of mental illness, such as chaplains, such as combat stress control teams, such as the non-commissioned leadership. I often say that the best screener is a good first sergeant who knows his or her men or women.
Well, that's Dr. Elspeth Cameron Ritchie. She's formerly the highest-ranking mental health officer in the Army. She served in the Army for 28 years and now works at the VA. Dr. Ritchie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got to have a permit to burn it, too. You have to have a permit to burn it. And there's an Ohio statute that says it's illegal. It's a class 2 misdemeanor or something to burn it.
We got a couple of delegates who would like an escort to get around to get into the convention center.
Pushing everybody that way, please. Would you please walk west? Everyone, please go west towards the Jack Casino. Clear the sidewalk. Keep moving. We need you to move west towards the Jack Casino. Everything is over.
You won't get away from God. You're going to stand before him someday, each one of us. You won't have your badge with you. You aren't going to have your camera with you.
Okay, some sounds from outside the arena last night, but what about inside? How will history view this week so far? Well, one historian is already thinking about that, Harvard historian Jill Lepore, staff writer for The New Yorker. She's here. Hi, Jill.
Hey, Robin.
Sitting right there. So far, as we said, I mean, there might be more protests tonight, but so far, much more police and military presence and journalists, you know, surrounding maybe one or two people carrying an assault rifle in an open gun state. It's almost comical. Pretty tame. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's actually, there have been times when I've been out there counting, it's a ratio of journalists to protesters is 10 to 1, which is, you know, an incredible relief for people. And there's been, though, I think, a kind of really interesting set of spontaneous moments. I mean, maybe they're a little bit staged, but on my way over here this morning, I crossed through Public Square into this beautiful plaza where many of the protesters have been gathering.
Which, by the way, I've wanted to say this, they have been speaking out there on, there's a speaker's thing.
There's a sound stage,
But there wasn't one back in the 1700s. The public square was there. But
yeah,
continue.
It was the public square. Yeah. It's been this very exciting place for free speech because it hasn't resulted in violence. And this morning when I was walking across, I stopped for a cup of coffee. They have a ping pong table out there. And there was a ping pong contest between the Indiana State Troopers and this bunch of, like, young black men. And there was this crowd.
How great.
You know, there are these lovely moments in a week that's been not the loveliest.
Well, we can talk about that inside the arena. Chris Christie, for instance, putting Hillary Clinton on trial, crowd chanting. Here's South Carolina Lieutenant Governor Henry McMaster. He delivered the second nominating speech for Donald Trump.
Today, the current administration has abandoned what little confidence they ever had in our Constitution and our country, and the world has lost confidence in us. The inevitable consequence? Weakness, decline, and ultimately, chaos and oblivion.
Yikes. Jill Lepore.
Yeah, I mean, each speech is like one Armageddon after the next. And there's this incredible sense of foreboding. And people came here to Cleveland after weeks of really very agonizing national and international news. I think kind of battered, really deeply concerned, saddened by what was going on in the country and around the world. And the greeting from the podium, this isn't from the floor with the delegates, but the speeches really, they're not that different from the guys marching down the street with the signs that read, repent, repent. I mean, there's just this sense of the coming catastrophe. And it's a strange choice of a political narrative. It's always been the case that conservatism is sort of backward-looking, right? The golden age lies in the past. And so returning to the greatness that America once was,
a lot of people genuinely feel.
Yeah, and that's not a novel thing. But this is different than that. It's making that argument contingent on accepting the idea that the present is catastrophic.
Well, compare it, for instance, to Ronald Reagan.
go.
Yeah, so Ronald Reagan had an incredible, you know, he really packaged a kind of nostalgia for the era in which he was a movie star, right? I mean, he's actually repackaging himself, looking back at that sort of 40s Reagan, that young, beautiful, handsome man. But he is nevertheless hoping to usher in a new day, a new beginning, morning in America. I mean, so much of his political rhetoric was forward-looking. So there was a hinge between the past was great, but the future is going to be even better. Yeah. And somehow the Trump campaign, the messaging coming off of that campaign, it has not yet made that turn. Yeah. And this kind of feeling of kind of sourness is kind of and grimness pervades the place. It's a tough sell for young people. I've been really struck. I spend most of my time in the public square because it's beautiful. It's an incredibly beautiful park. Mm. Talking, especially younger people who are there. And as you say, not so much in big groups, but singly or in twos. You know, a couple University of Cincinnati students I sat down with yesterday. And they're not that, you know, they're really concerned about things going on in the world. They're not happy with either of the major party candidates. I across the spectrum, I haven't found young people who are excited about either of the major party candidates.
They're not being offered hope. Jill Lepore, one quick thing. You noticed something about the archivist here, just very briefly.
Yeah, I stopped at the Historical Society, and I said, what are you guys collecting? They have this incredible memorabilia from 1924 and 1936, the last two conventions. I was like, you know, they have these ponchos, and they're like, we don't know what to collect. There are no paper tickets this time around.
Everything's digital. You know what they were also saying? That's Jill Lepore, Harvard historian, Jill Lepore, staff writer for The New Yorker. Thanks as always.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.